This is the smell of a warm 3-day-old egg salad sandwich in a wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, wimpy, wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a hefty, ultra-strong trash bag with new Fabuloso lemon scent.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Smell the difference? When life gives you stinky, get hefty, ultra-strong with new Fabuloso lemon scent. It smells like clean, freshly picked lemons. So no matter what's inside your trash, you can stop the stink and smell the lemon.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Chiral Assateur, the co-founder and CEO of Centerfin in New York. Chiral, thank you for rejoining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today.
Nat, thank you for having me again, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. It's great to have you. And you were on this show almost exactly a year ago, and you made some predictions, some of which turned out to be quite prescient. You said that we're unlikely to have a recession, and you were also short bonds, which worked out for about 10 months of the year, which is good enough. So, curious now what your views are on the coming 12 months for markets, for the economy. Are we going to get a recession? Yeah, these are all things I would like to know. I'm sure our listeners would as well. So I will shut up and let you talk and tell us about it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Thank you. And, you know, I think our view last year, our view today on the kind of global macro, right? The bigger picture is generally, it's not like we were predicting last year that we're not going to get a recession. But generally speaking, when you look at consensus estimates by, you know, when you get all these, you know, 2024 predictions that you're seeing right now, it's very rare that those come true, right? It's often the case that something else happens. And
so does it ever come true?
You know, I don't know. Somebody should actually look at that and see if consensus is ever the right way to go. But so our view is basically, look, nobody really knows anything as it comes to the macros. We can make predictions that are informed based on what's going on, based on our views, based on what we're seeing from, you know, companies specifically and from some of the macro factors specifically. But at the end of the day, it's really hard to make those calls. And I think that we were of that same mind a year ago when we spoke, which is, you know, look, everybody's talking about a recession, but everybody was talking about a recession at the end of 2021 also, if you recall. And we said the same thing. Look, you know, it makes sense. And we actually did get 2 negative GDP prints in 2022, if you recall, but it wasn't called a recession. But I guess our point is, you know, it's really hard to make those macro calls. And so we're not by any means, you know, any better informed than anybody else. And so we're not going to try to make those macro calls. We're just going to look at, you know, where the markets are, you know, on a valuation basis, what potential sectors are in favor, out of favor in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months in the kind of intermediate term. But longer term, you know, as I think we discussed last year, you know, our clients have a long time horizon. And so the vast majority of the exposure we're going to have for them is in equities, because that's what you want to have longer term. It's just a matter of, you know, how you express that view is really the nuanced difference in how we look at it. And so, you know, our view is generally speaking, you know, just passive equity exposures, probably not the way to go at this stage anyway. And so you want to have a little bit more, you know, you pick and choose your sectors, you know, maybe use some managers here and there, depending on what part of the market we're talking about. But that's been our view since the beginning. That's why we started the company. And that continues to be our view. So, you know, to kind of rewind 2023, you know, everybody thought we were going to recession. We were not so clear that we were going into recession. Then you hit the first quarter and we have a mini banking crisis, right? You had some of the biggest banking failures that we've seen since the financial crisis. And quite frankly, that was interesting because we were looking at the banking sector and we were focused on the smaller end of the banking sector because of commercial real estate, right? So, you know, in late 2022, internally, we were discussing, you know, what are the potential risks out there from this kind of higher rate regime that are fairly obvious. And, you know, one of the most obvious risks is real estate and real estate held by the commercial real estate exposure held by some of the smaller commercial banks. And that actually ended up playing out, but for the wrong reasons, right? So it wasn't the commercial real estate that really hurt them. It was the rates, and you know, for Silicon Valley Bank, it was their venture capital investments that and their client base that they had. So anyway, so we went through that, and then the Fed stepped in with the BTFP program, which is kind of interesting. Which was, you know, I think if you look at the history of what the Fed does during crises, you shouldn't be too surprised that they provided, you know, this you know, temporary facility for the banks to be able to withstand these moves. And that kind of quieted things down for a bit, right? And then we kind of resumed this rally led by now, you know, now it's been talked about enough that, you know, I don't need to tell you, but the Magnificent Seven, right? The biggest technology companies are a huge exposure in the S&P 500, and they've represented the vast majority of the return of the S&P 500 for this year. I think the interesting turning point that we saw was that at some point the markets stopped focusing. So last year it was all about inflation, right? We were focused on inflation because that gave us insight potentially into what the Fed was going to do. And that gave us insight potentially into what, you know, how to price risk assets, right? And then this year, it seems like at some point, you know, inflation started to come down and that became fairly obvious. And the focus switched not from, is inflation still a risk? It's really, what is the Fed going to do? And are rates going to stay higher for longer? Because that's been what the Fed has been talking about. And if you recall, kind of in the late summer going into the fourth quarter, we saw the long end of the curve spike in yield, right? And the narrative that was driving that was, you know, our fiscal situation's terrible. We're running a big fiscal deficit, even though we're in, you know, quote unquote peacetime, even though there are two wars that are happening as we speak. We're running a fiscal deficit. You know, the interest rates are higher than they've been in the last 15 years. And can we actually afford this, right? And so you saw the long end of the bond market spike in yields, and that caused a big sell-off in risk assets, right? And so that was all of, you know, basically October. And really what stopped that and has been now confirmed was when Secretary of the Treasury Yellen came out and said, listen, you know, we're not going to finance, you know, this fiscal deficit with long bonds. We're going to use a lot more short-term, you know, T-bills and short duration bonds. And that really calmed the market down from the perspective of, you know, are these long bonds going to get out of control? And so that's when you saw this big relief rally. You saw it in risk assets and, you know, stocks and in bonds over the course of November. And then, of course, you know, last week, and I'm glad we had to put off this this recording by about a week, because I don't think anybody was predicting, neither were we, nor did we try. But nobody was expecting this Powell pivot that we got last Wednesday, which basically then, you know, added another layer of kind of comfort to the market in that he basically said, look, we're done hiking and the path of interest rates now is lower, right? Mm-hmm. He's never said that this year, even as recent as, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, he was sticking to the higher for longer mandate in the narrative. And so markets, as you know, hate uncertainty. And so when the Secretary of the Treasury responding from kind of the federal government side of things said, look, we're going to, you know, we understand yields are, you know, interest rates are higher and we're in a bad fiscal situation. So we're going to finance the government with short-term paper. That gave comfort to the markets from that perspective. And then now the Fed came out last week and basically said, look, we're done raising interest rates. We're going to lower interest rates next year. The timing doesn't really matter. The magnitude doesn't really matter. It's just the direction that matters. And so that gave a lot more comfort to the market since last week. Surprisingly, though, what's been interesting, what we've observed, and this is you know, partially, I think, healthy, is the leadership since the Fed pivot last week has come from the out of favor sectors of the market and the companies really that have not participated in the rally. So if you look at the, you know, the Magnificent Seven, they're up, but the market overall is up higher, and there's small, smaller companies are up much higher. Certain, you know, more speculative parts of the market are up much higher since this Fed pivot. So so I guess overall going into 2024, now everybody is talking about a soft landing. And that's pretty much consensus. I literally just saw a chart from every bank. Every bank shows a either very shallow recession or a soft landing, no recession. We just go on. Again, we're going to say it's unlikely that we see that consensus. And so what are the other two scenarios? Now, the one much talked about, and you've had some guests on that I think have talked about this, right, is that there's a lag effect to these interest rate hikes and that it will feed through the economy on a lag. And then you're going to see a recession later than we would have expected. I think that a little bit of that narrative potentially, was hurt by the Powell pivot, because now, you know, he's basically saying we're lowering interest rates and there is no recession in sight. And so it's hard to make that case, I think. And then the flip side of the coin is like, what if the economy reaccelerates, right? And like, what if we actually show strength this year? You know, I just looked at earnings. This year, earnings were flat, basically. I think the projected, when all is said and done, year-over-year earnings growth is like 0.6% for the year, right? Next year, we're projecting, as we usually do, growth of, I think, you know, low teens or something like that for the S&P 500. We're trading at high multiples, right? So we're trading at 19 to 20 times on the S&P. Does that mean that the stock market rallies, even if the economy accelerates? You know, it's hard to make the point that the stock market rallies significantly from here. But I think that everybody expecting this like soft landing or potential recession and a stock market crash, is potentially that case is potentially not as evident as it was even a couple of weeks ago.
Which case? The case for a soft landing or the case for the case for a crash?
For both.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
If you want to be contrarian, as to the name of your podcast, you definitely don't want to go with what the, you know, current consensus is, which is a soft landing. And that's been driving the market for the last couple of months. I think that the crash, you know, I think that there's some probability of a crash, but that the probability of a crash, it probably comes with some exogenous risk that we are not considering, right? And there's certainly plenty of things to worry about, but there's always plenty of things to worry about. But, you know, more recently you've had, you know, this activity in the Middle East where, you know, the shipping companies have had to reroute their ships around Africa because, you know, they're being bombed in the Red Sea by drones. You know, is that potentially something that can flare up into a bigger conflict in the Middle East? Of course. But what is the probability of that going into an election year? You know, it's hard to tell. And so, you know, I guess our point is, you know, we think the economy is doing fine. There's not a ton of evidence that we're going to go into some sort of deep recession. There is some potential that we actually, you know, accelerate from here. But does that mean that stock do well from here on a kind of index level basis? Probably not, because they're already relatively richly priced. And so you have to kind of focus on certain companies or sectors that are more attractively priced. And so we think, you know, some of the other out of favor stuff that has not participated in the rally of 2023, you know, will start to, you know, participate or catch up, so to speak, into 2024.
Okay, let's hold off on discussing those sectors just for a minute, because there are some things. You covered a lot of ground here. And there's a couple of things I want to ask you about based on what you just said. One of them is the possibility, basically the fact that the Fed is going to cut rates. This has now effectively been priced in. And Powell said as much. And certainly the bond market shows this. And so do Fed fund futures. But the question is, how can he cut rates if inflation is still a full percent above the 2% mandate that they need it to be? That's number one. And number two, like you said, there are no signs really of the economy slowing. I guess maybe in employment numbers, some. But then you have other things like housing coming back and asset prices, like you said, looking quite good. So it's seems like it's a bit of a difficult case to make to cut rates into all of this. Is it not?
Yeah, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you look at just the data and you rewind the videotape and you look at how what the Fed has been focused on and how very disciplined they've tried to be in keeping this higher for longer narrative in light of the fact that the inflation is still above their target and unemployment, to your point, we've seen a little bit of softness, but it's still fairly tight, right? The labor market's tight. And so their dual mandate is employment and price stability. Employment is still fine. Price stability is still not fine based on their interpretation of it, but it's heading in the right direction. And I think that look, we can't argue with what the Fed is going to do. The Fed is going to do what they're going to do. What I think that is more important than even whether it's right or wrong is the fact that they told us that they're going to cut rates, or at least they told us that the direction of rates is down next year instead of flat to potentially even up, which is what was kind of discussed over the course of the last year. But I completely agree with you that, you probably run more of a risk, to my point earlier about kind of reacceleration, right? But, if this is stimulative to the economy, if they, the implied cutting of rates, which was already reflected in the bond market, as you said, is stimulative to the economy. And if that flares up inflation again, we're going to be in a little bit of a pickle. And by we, I mean the Fed. The chairman, Jay Powell, has wanted to avoid any comparison to the 1970s and, what happened with Arthur Burns and Volcker. But, in doing what he's doing, he's running that risk.
Yeah. So risks, you would think maybe potentially to the upside there. And, the credibility, after all this talk about price stability, going back to his Jackson Hole speech last summer, in the summer of 22, and everything he said up until this last meeting, how can they now cut rates in the face of this? Unless, of course, inflation comes down a lot and the economy falls off of a cliff over the next couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, look, the only two possible explanations are, and I've heard people talk about this since last week also, are that, maybe the Fed sees something we don't see and that there's a bigger slowdown happening under the surface and hence they want to get ahead of it. That's one explanation. The other explanation is, politics, which, it's hard to make that case, but obviously we're going into an election year. The incumbent government's going to do anything that they can in order to have a strong economy going into the election, right? Mm-hmm. Again, that's, there's a little bit more of a conspiracy yeah. theory, yeah. Tilt to that, mm-hmm. To that element. But no, you're absolutely right. It's hard to understand why the change of tone and why this pivot at this stage when, there is no evidence that inflation, the trend of inflation has bottomed or the trend of inflation has continued to go down to their kind of targeted level, right? Mm-hmm. We're still, we still saw our 4% print in the last inflation print in the CPI print, right? And I would argue most people experience, my argument about, we're sitting here arguing about, academically, what is the CPI number, what's the PCE deflator, and what is the Fed going to do based on those things. But arguably, people, everyday people, which is what the Fed, seems to have been telling us that they care about, they're still experiencing inflation, right? So when you go to a restaurant out, prices are still a lot higher than they used to be because those restaurants are not going to just lower prices after they've raised them, right? And so you're still seeing higher prices for things. And that's the element about inflation that I think, not to get into it, and again, we're not economists, and we don't think that anybody has a good explanation, but there is a psychological element to inflation, which is, when people are experiencing higher prices for goods and services, which they are, and they continue to experience them, they also go back and demand higher wages, right? Because that's the only way that they can afford the higher price of goods and services. And we've seen that wage pressure, right? So I think that the thing to focus on is, whether wage inflation is under control or not. And I don't think anybody knows, but that's going to determine, I think, what happens with inflation going forward and whether or not the Fed is, a little ahead of itself here.
Although one other thing here is one element that they exclude from their core, but gas prices, if you look at the pump, have come down. And interestingly, this Red Sea stuff has not really caused, or at all caused, a spike in oil prices. So that would indicate that the market is not really placing all that much risk into that particular geopolitical possibility. Obviously, there's other things affecting oil prices, but is there that too?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, gas prices have come down. Oil, we've thrown a lot at the oil market this year in terms of geopolitical risk, including this recent war in the Middle East. And prices have been stubbornly, for the bulls, low. And I think that that's pretty telling. And I think that's been good for the consumer. But yeah, I mean, the market seems to not be pricing in a ton of that geopolitical risk into the oil market. And maybe that has to do with the fact that, instead of, the US production of oil, I mean, I think we talked about this last year, right? We're fully sufficient in terms of being able to produce enough oil or energy domestically to support ourselves, right? So the Middle East, where historically we've needed them to import energy, is not as important anymore. So maybe there's an element of that. I'd say, if you look at, we talked about it last time, and we continue to have this view, but if you look at kind of the gold market, as something else as a proxy for geopolitical risk, that's actually been trading a little bit more. I mean, gold's like kind of at all-time highs. It's been threatening to break out. That's actually been trading a little bit more like a geopolitical hedge, if you want to call it
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details. contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets. such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show. All right, so let's talk sectors then. What parts of the economy do you like? Obviously, this is not investment advice, but just in terms of, yeah, broadly overall sectors, what you're more bullish about going into 2024?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, we recently made some changes in the client portfolios. We've had a relatively balanced approach to our equities portfolio, balanced between kind of more defensive equities and you know, higher growth equities. You want to have exposure to all of those things, because at the end of the day, like I said, from a long-term perspective, you want to have a lot of equity exposure for your clients. It's just a matter of like, how do you position yourself in the short to intermediate term? And so we were kind of balanced going into 2023. And that's worked out, you know, completely fine through the end of the year. I think that going into 2024, we've added a little bit more weight to out of favor things that we think potentially could benefit. So, you know, I mentioned small caps before. We've had, you know, a lot more exposure to small caps than, you know, the broad indices have no exposure to small caps, obviously, right? The S&P doesn't have any small caps. But, you know, we've had exposure both actively and passively to small cap equities. And we've added to that because we feel like that there is more value there. And that's, you know, probably one of the, you know, there's nothing obvious in this market, but that's something that I think is reasonable. And then we've added to, you know, we've had more exposure to healthcare. And that hasn't worked this year, and biotech, and that hasn't worked this year. But we've decided to kind of leave those at slightly lower allocation levels, you know, even though they haven't worked, so they've gotten smaller over time. And instead, what we've added to are industrials and financials, which, you know, industrials have participated in this last rally, and financials have started to participate, but they were definitively not the leaders going into it, right? We continue to be led by, you know, the big technology companies this year. And so that's how we were thinking about it. I think at the end of the day, more importantly, you know, we continue to believe this, the market environment, you know, everybody's so surprised. S&P's up 20, you know, whatever it is, 22, 23, 24% this year. You know, the vast majority of that, again, seven stocks. It's a really a function if you look at it as to how this index is created, right? You have the biggest companies, I think it's top 10 companies, are now 30% of the index, right? Wow. It's fairly concentrated. Those are the vast majority of those top 10 companies are technology companies, right? Mm. And that's been the leadership since the financial crisis. Basically, coming out of the financial crisis, we saw leadership from the technology companies. You know, if you go back to, you know, we met in the hedge fund world, right? If you go back to, you know, if you were an institutional allocator sitting with a hedge fund and you were to ask them, how concentrated are you? And they were to say, well, look, my top 10 names are 30%. For a hedge fund, then maybe that's not super concentrated, but it's not concentrated, right? Especially when your top position is maybe, you know, 10% plus, sure, which is what it is in S&P 500, right? And so I think that, you know, some of the things that, you know, we've been talking about and concerned about is, does this, you know, does just buying the index make sense anymore when you have this concentration issue? And that leadership in market cycles is generally not the same, right? So like, you know, if you go back, there's really cool YouTube videos on, you know, market caps of companies over long periods of time. And you go back into the 80s and 90s and 2000s and 2010s and 2020s, they're all very different, right? And they change over time, depending on how, you know, what the economy looks like. And it's not unreasonable to think that leadership going forward, based on how the economy is evolving, will continue to be in technology companies. However, is it going to be the same technology companies that kind of led us into this part of the of time? And it doesn't seem likely. And so what happens at the index level, if you just think about it conceptually from a common sense perspective, those companies that have become very, very large, if they're not the leadership and there's new leadership coming up, they're going to stay stagnant. Maybe they shrink in market cap and overall exposure while the new leadership comes up, you know, comes up in terms of market cap, and then the index doesn't go anywhere, right? And so, and that's what you saw really from 2000 to 2010, right? The S&P 500 made no money over that period of time because there was this internal change of leadership. And we think that there's more likely than not in 2020, in the 20s, which is where we're in the early stages of, we think that there might be that dynamic going forward, which is why you really need to be thoughtful about how you construct a portfolio, not just at the index level, but picking and choosing sectors and being somewhat active about it as things change.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on AI? Because that's been one of the things that has driven the technology boom this year, and some would say hype.
Probably one of the biggest surprises of 2023 has been how strong that narrative has been, right? And listen, half our team are technology folks, and they've been all over, the ChatGPT and all the other AIs since the beginning, which is only, by the way, a year ago, right? So it's relatively new in terms of this iteration of artificial intelligence, this, language learning models that you could interact with in this way. That's relatively new. So obviously that's driven massive value creation for a company like NVIDIA and some other companies that benefit from making the GPUs to use in this technology. We think it's kind of too early to tell in what that means longer term, because, I'll tell you, I use ChatGPT, this is personally, now instead of Google, right?
Okay.
So I don't Google anything anymore, largely. Ever since ChatGPT got access to the internet, which is recent, I can ask ChatGPT to look up things for me and to come back with an answer to something instead of, previously, what I had to do was Google stuff. And, we've all done this, right? You Google, you have a question, you Google it, and then you get a bunch of links, and then you click on the links and you read, and you finally get to a link that has the answer you're looking for. Maybe it's a compilation of that. ChatGPT effectively does that for you, right? It kind of, looks at the web, it searches for relevant answers, and then it kind of compiles it for you. And so that's a massive productivity boost for me personally, right? And we think that that's going to be implemented across different industries, and it will have a massive effect. And quite frankly, that is potentially, what the market is pricing in as kind of this very rosy scenario, right? So when I say, could we see a reacceleration of the economy, it's because the market's been kind of pricing that in ahead of time, but it's because, some of this technology starts to filter through into the real economy, we actually see it in growth. But I do think it's too early to tell, because it seems like, it's going to be very slow in being implemented in different industries. And obviously certain industries like technology companies will be faster than other industries, like, let's say banks and
manufacturing or whatever,
auto manufacturing companies. But it is a super interesting, powerful technology. I personally use it. I think it's super interesting. My team uses it. We've been exploring ways of utilizing it in our company. But it's still relatively new.
Is it really that useful? I mean, I've used it too, but okay. Like you said, it skips a step there of having to click on the links. So that's a step, but it's not like, moving from printing press to internet, right? Like, or is it? I don't know.
It's not, except that I think that it has the benefit of potentially being, from, again, the printing press to the internet is a massive, a massive shift in, how we were able to disseminate information and consume information, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is a little bit different in that this is, we already have this access to information. We've had the World Wide Web for decades now. And we've moved it from, computers to mobile over the last 20 years. This is a little bit of a different thing, where it's not really how we access the data. It's what can we do with that data? And so it's almost like, the way I kind of think about it, it's like a personal, it has the potential, it's not there yet, but it has the potential to be like a personal assistant, right? And so if it can create, like, I think about it from the perspective of my industry, the wealth management industry and financial services in general, right? if it could create the equivalent of an analyst level worker for you for very limited cost, that's potentially game changing, right? Because all of a sudden, you don't need to hire that headcount, or you can have that headcount focused on something else, because all of that work that you would have an analyst do, which is really, research and putting stuff together, if that can be done by an AI, which I think it can, well, that's a huge productivity boost, right? And so that, that person can now focus on other things that are going to become, more value add in the economy, than just, putting together research and, and putting it together for a presentation or whatever it might be. That's where I think it's potentially really powerful. And that, that application you can see across, various industries, right? It's super interesting.
Yeah, 100%. And I can tell you from my experience that the writing that ChatGPT does, while sometimes a little flawed, and sometimes without downright mistakes, actually, is still better than a junior level reporter, in my experience. Like, I would much rather have a ChatGPT written thing than something that came from a 20 whatever year old reporter, just speaking from personal experience. But
That's super interesting. That's a super interesting observation. For somebody who spends their time writing content, to say that's pretty powerful.
Having said that, it needs to be fact checked and it does need to be edited. So there is that. But then junior reporters need to be fact checked and edited and oftentimes ghostwritten. And the ghostwriting part is it's something you don't have to really do anymore. Well, depending on what the style is. But anyway, yeah, interesting stuff. Wow. Okay, that's all very interesting. So a bunch of hot topics here. I'd like to ask, what are your concerns, your biggest concerns going to 2024? You touched on some of it, the geopolitical stuff. That seems to be a major flashpoint. Again, the last 2 years have seen these huge flare-ups, the Russia, Ukraine, and now in the Middle East. So I would assume that's up or near the top of the list, but is there anything else? Or maybe, yeah, talk to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a th those are top of the list, definitely. But like I say, there's always that stuff to worry about. Has it gotten a little bit more acute over the last, decade or so? It seems like it has. And I think it somewhat has to do with this changing dynamic. We've written a lot about like the changing dynamic between the Western and Eastern worlds, right? There's no denying the fact that our relationship with China is very different than it was 2 decades ago. Clearly our relationship with Russia is very different, but there seems to be, a new economic axis, for lack of a better explanation, that's trying to kind of form to replace or try and try to usurp the US as the global dominant economy and world power, right? That's clearly what's happening, and it's happening very slowly. And I don't think that we can say, there's been this like recent narrative of comparing the US to the late Roman Empire. I think there are some things that you can glean from that, but and there, certainly seem right, but I don't think those things happen, over short periods of time. Those things take long periods of time. And so I think the geopolitical conflicts, I think we probably expect more of those things. Again, the market has not seemed to care. To your point, right? Like we saw this, this war in Israel that started in early October. The typical reactions that you would see, we saw some of them, but not really any reflection of that becoming a real big thing. And so those are definitely top of mind. I would say like more, closer to home, right? I would say, if inflation is not really a solved problem, like the Fed has effectively declared as of last week, that's really harmful to a huge part of society. And it's the, you know, this is really the part of the society that does not own financial assets, which is kind of what we're talking about here. And I'd say that that is something, that I think we just need to pay attention to, because, Powell, to his credit, he said, at every press conference, he said, and I actually don't know if he said it last week or not, but he said, we know inflation is hurting people because, you know, it's hitting them, you know, in their wallet, and people are having a hard time, you know, surviving and living healthy, you know, financial lives. Well, if inflation kind of reaccelerates from here, that's gonna continue to be a problem. And so, and that's, you know, that comes with it, you know, that brings with it, you know, potential social tension, you know, which, you know, we've seen a little bit of, you know, over the last, you know, couple of years, maybe even longer. But that's something also to pay attention to. But I'm not sure, you know, how you can play that from a, you know, financial or investing perspective.
Good points. Yeah, speaking of which, you didn't mention the U.S. election in 2024, which I suspect we might be hearing about a little bit. Not to talk about politics, which is outlawed on this podcast, but just the economic and market impact of what that could bring, if any. Do you see any potential for anything there?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, we, you know, I did briefly mention that, you know, I think that the incumbent federal government always tries to do whatever they can to make the economy strong into that election year so that, you know, so that people feel good and, you know, and their voting reflects that. So I would expect the Biden administration to do what they can, you know, within their powers to help the economy, which is another reason why, you know, it's hard. You know, for the people that are calling for a hard recession or hard landing, right? It's, you know, you're talking about going into election year where the federal government's just going to throw a lot of stuff at the economy, because that's what they do. So I think that is something to be aware of. You know, there was news yesterday about Trump and Colorado, you know, taking them off the ballot, taking him off the ballot as an official presidential candidate. I think that's gonna, you know, that's very new. But that's going to create some uncertainty. You know, all, generally speaking, there's a lot of uncertainty about this election, and markets don't like uncertainty. And so I think we're going to probably balance, you know, the incumbent government, you know, trying to stimulate the economy and make people feel good into this election year with a lot of the uncertainty around, like, who's, you know, is Biden even our candidate for 2024, and who are the Republican candidates, and what does that bring with it? So it's gonna be an interesting one. I don't think it's gonna be a boring year.
Interesting is an interesting way of describing it. Yes, very cool. All right, Carl Assater, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. In closing, maybe you could tell our listeners how they can find out more about you and about Centerfin. I will put that in the show notes. I've noticed you aren't that active on social media anymore. Maybe it's somehow our algorithms aren't matching up or something since the switch there. But yeah, how do we do that?
Yeah, so I still try to be active on Twitter. Wall Street Hobbs is my nick is my call sign. Centerfin.co, Cairo@centerfin.co is how you can reach me. You know, Centerfin, again, as we've discussed before, a modern wealth management platform. We're really focused on, you know, combining technology and human experience. We think that that's how you create the best, most modern offering for clients, and at the end of the day, our goal is to deliver value to clients, and so that's what we try to do every day.
Well, have you tried plugging in asset allocation into AI and just being like, what's the best asset allocation right now?
Oh gosh, yes, we've tried a lot of that stuff. It's not to be done, you know, and with any real money at this point. I think there's a lot of people talking about that, and I think it's pretty dangerous, because you know, I don't think by any means. Listen, there's been forms of AI that have been used in investing by quant shops for decades, right? So it's not like you can't use it, but I'm saying, like, you know, trying to use something like the recent language learning models in you know, actually managing money, I think is a no go at this stage. And anybody who's talking about it, that's definitely a little dangerous with it.
All right. Cool. Well, thanks, Carl, for coming on again. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back here again in weeks. Speak then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.